طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This is your host, John Roberts. We have a really full program for you today, as we continue our coverage of the recently concluded annual Washington Report on Middle East Affairs Conference. We feature Mondo Weiss founder Philip Weiss, who will speak on J Street and the limitations of liberal Zionism, followed by Tom Suarez, who will speak on the weaponization of anti-Semitism.
Thanks so much. As Grant mentioned, J Street wrapped up its conference this week, so we thought it was fitting to begin today's event with a reflection on that event. And for that, we are very pleased and lucky to be joined by Philip Weiss, who is a co-editor of Mondo Weiss, a news website devoted to covering American foreign policy in the Middle East, chiefly from a progressive Jewish perspective. Phil watched most of the J Street conference, and will now take a few moments, about 10, 15 minutes, I mean, or 15 or 20 minutes, to give us his thoughts on the event and what it means for the current status of liberal Zionism. So, Phil, we're happy to have you, and the platform is all yours.
Thanks very much, Dale. And thanks to the conference for having me. It's a wonderful conference. I enjoyed last weekend, and that's a hard act to follow. Susie Abahawa and Ian Williams and Brian Baird, among others, and John Doe, very impressive. So my job today, I'm going to talk about a split within the Israel lobby between the right center, AIPAC, and the left center, which is J Street. And I am going to sort of lay out what is significant about this split within the Jewish community. And that is really where I'm coming from here. I'm Jewish, and I'm very interested in Jewish politics in the United States because I think they're so important in shaping foreign policy. I think some of that's the elephant in the room, and it reminds me of the old joke about nine blind people with an elephant trying to figure out what an elephant is. And I think some of that mystification and confusion exists around the Israel lobby and foreign policy. And even in our communities, you'll have a certain analysis of, is it a military industrial complex that's driving material interest, imperialism that's driving our policy in the Middle East? Is it settler colonialism? Is it geopolitical strategy versus China and Russia? And then what is the role of the Israel lobby? And that's really my focus is fairly narrow on the tail of the elephant here, and that is not the evangelical Christian lobby, which is a significant part of the Israel lobby, but the Jewish part and Jewish politics. And so it's very J Street is now represents that kind of left wing of the Israel lobby. They are, as Grant pointed out, strongly supportive of American support to Israel. They want to maintain a Jewish state in the Middle East. And they want a two-state solution to preserve that Jewish state, and they are going to lobby Congress to do so. And I think that they have been fairly successful in establishing themselves as an access organization. That's ultimately what a lobby is cares about access. It wants to get access in Washington. And J Street has had over the last 13, 14 years of its existence, 13 years, has had a pretty smooth and strong flight path towards greater and greater influence, to the point that it can claim that most of the Democratic majority in Congress was endorsed by J Street. And the White House, the occupants of the White House, Biden and Harris, were also endorsed by J Street. So that type of endorsement success and presumably donors, because money is at the heart of the Israel lobby, that should equate to a certain amount of access and influence on J Street's part. I think the jury's still out on that, how much influence it has, and but it is gaining influence. And the question is, what are its goals? And will it be able to maintain those goals in the face of strong headwinds from the left, including events like this conference, which focus on apartheid? And I thought that it was kind of interesting that there was, at the J Street conference, there was even a certain nostalgia for the Trump era. They had a whole video about all these things that had happened under Trump and all the things we did to mobilize against Trump. And personally, you know, he's the last guy. I saw enough of that guy when he was in the White House. I don't want to see him again. And it's painful to watch that kind of stuff. But it speaks to the fact that when Trump was in the White House, J Street could unify, could say, we're unified on the left. We're trying to get Trump out. We have, let's all pull together on this goal. We're against, we're a social justice organization, and we're involved with the progressive left and in the sort of more moderate elements of the foreign policy community, that we just want to get Trump out. And now that Trump is out, and J Street was also able to say, hey, everything you want to do in Israel, get rid of, is to get rid of Netanyahu. And we're just trying to do that in the United States. We're trying to get rid of our Netanyahu, Donald Trump. And now that Donald Trump is gone, it sort of pulls the rug out from under their messaging, J Street's messaging, in that the left is now saying, yeah, you got rid of Trump, but there's a lot more work to be done in this country. J Street says, yeah. And but you haven't gotten rid of your Trump in Israel. And in fact, your Trump in Israel seems to be even more cemented in power than ever, whether that's Netanyahu or the right. Israel is an overwhelmingly right-wing country. The latest elections just go to show that close to 80 out of 120 members of the Knesset, two-thirds of the Knesset is right-wing and right-wing Jewish. And so there have been four elections in Israel. You haven't changed that at all, J Street. That country is right wing. And increasingly, elements of the progressive left in the United States and the think tank foreign policy community, the quote unquote blob in Washington, increasingly they are getting impatient, I think, with, well, certainly the left is really impatient with Israel. And elements of the foreign policy establishment are as well. And Zaha Hassan will talk to you later about a really important paper from Carnegie about this, where the sort of foreign policy establishment is saying, we don't care about a two-state solution. We don't care about a Jewish state even. We just want rights for Palestinians. So I think that the first pressure, J Street is under pressure from the left, and it's under pressure from the right. And I want to describe those two pressures and where they end up and where what I think will develop from that. So I'm talking about a sort of fracture within the Jewish community and within the Israel lobby itself. The pressure from the left is, as I've just described, is from progressives in this country who are expecting a lot more of our country in social justice issues. And of course, in Israel and Palestine, where there's apartheid. And this is a community that largely supports BDS, boycotts, divestment, sanctions, active measures to nonviolent measures to put Israel, to pressure Israel to change. And that supports the International Criminal Court investigation that of potential prosecution of Israel and Palestine that began in February, and that supports these findings of apartheid. B'Tselem issued this finding of apartheid that Grant mentioned. And these are all things that the left emphasizes, that J Street can't talk about. It can't talk about the International Criminal Court. It can't talk about apartheid. The only references to apartheid during the whole conference were from Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, and also Breaking the Silence, an Israeli organization. But J Street itself just talked about deepening occupation and creeping annexation. That's its way of describing the apartheid process. It can't go there. It has to sort of cut the left wing discussion out. It's too threatening to a core value of J Street, which is support for a Jewish state. And the BDS campaign, the International Criminal Court prosecution, and the apartheid discourse, all of these elements potentially threaten, or I think do threaten, the existence of a Jewish state, because they make it clear that there's a clear understanding that the Israel's character as a Jewish state is preventing it from granting anything like equal status to Palestinians. And in fact, it's a horrifying situation, as was made clear two nights ago by this mob marching through Jerusalem, calling for saying death to Arabs, a Jewish mob of Jewish supremacists, openly Jewish supremacist organization, marching into East Jerusalem, attacking Palestinian houses, calling for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And this is that faction is now in the Israeli Knesset. It had previously been banned from the Knesset, and now it's part of the Israeli Knesset in this religious Zionism party, which won six seats in the March election. So J Street faces this pressure from the left to say something about this, and it's not able to really say something about that. It talks about just deepening occupation. Now, at its conference, and I don't know if Grant can cue this video, J Street did have a number of videos of extremely disturbing events on the West Bank. And one of them is this video you're about to see from Jalud near Nablus, where you see these settlers coming down and throwing rocks at this Palestinian farmer. I mean, just a horrifying video. I have to turn away. I've seen this a couple of times. It's so upsetting. And the thing that is the most upsetting about this is that nothing is happening about this. Nothing is happening to stop this. Israel has complete impunity on this behavior. And J Street, to its credit, aired this video and others at its conference. Michael Sfard, a wonderful human rights attorney, aired these videos. And when the left sees this, and when I think dispassionate foreign policy observers see this video, what they see is apartheid. This is plainly apartheid, in as much as the soldiers are on the settler's side. This is an occupied territory. And yet J Street is unable to contend with this. On the other side, J Street arose in opposition to the center-right Israel lobby. And J Street does represent a very important break inside the Jewish community. And I think this is something that I don't want to diminish. The Jewish politics of this are very important. If you think that the Jewish foreign policy community and the lobby supported the Iraq war in 2003 and faced a lot of political heat for that subsequently, J Street has arisen against that, that strain in the foreign policy establishment that does everything, has the United States acting on behalf of Israel. J Street has taken some strong stands against that sort of trend, notably in its support for the Iran deal, which has been fantastic. And I don't know that we would have had an Iran deal in 2015. I don't know that the momentum would exist now to restore the Iran deal were it not for a portion of the liberal Zionist community, J Street, Americans for Peace Now, saying, yes, get back into the Iran deal. So J Street has taken on, out of principle, has taken on the right-wing Jewish pro-Israel lobby on very important issues, like the Iran deal. And even this week, J Street marked its independence by supporting a Betty McCollum's historic legislation. The Minnesota congresswoman, St. Paul, I used to live in her district, that would prohibit U.S. aid going to house demolitions and detaining Palestinian children. This is a historic moment in advancing pro-Palestinian legislation, and J Street signed on. It's a wonderful thing that they signed on. Lots of civil society organizations across the United States signed on the left and the center. It's great that they all signed on. But within Jewish politics, J Street signed on to this bill that AIPAC, the right-wing lobby, hates, and that has only gotten 15 sponsors in the House. And AIPAC, meanwhile, has gotten 330 congresspeople to say never limit U.S. aid to Israel. We must keep the aid flowing. So in this respect, I think J Street has taken a very important stance and should be celebrated for it. But and it's threatening its own access gain by doing so. It alienates itself from the center Israel lobby, and ultimately J Street is in an access game. It's trying to get access to foreign policy leaders, and it's doing so through the old chemistry of joining up with other powerful Jewish organizations and using donor money, just what Brian Baird talked about last week. And it has split the lobby on this question of sort of unfettered military aid to Israel. And it said, no, there have to be some limits. At the same time, though, the left discussion is outpacing J Street. So it's balanced between trying to stay an access organization and trying to stay in good odor with the centrist Israel lobby and with the Jewish community. And by doing so, it says explicitly, we don't want anything to do with the Phil Weisses of the Jewish community. Jeremy Ben-Ami, the head of J Street, says this directly to me. You're an anti-Zionist. We don't want you in our community. Okay, that they get to define their community how they like. But the left, I think, is turning increasingly towards anti-Zionism. And that's because that video you just saw is a manifestation, ultimately, of Zionism. I think that is an understanding that has just grown on the left, is now firmly established. You can hear it during this. The great thing about this conference is that you're going to hear this type of analysis from, you know, me, parochial me inside the left-wing Jewish community. And you'll hear from foreign policy realists. You'll hear it from anti-settler colonialist, anti-settler colonial left-wing internationalist understanding. So this is a very broad understanding that Zionism is the problem, and that an ideology of Jewish nationalism is what produced that video you just saw. That it has Jewish nationalism has not worked out. It's just created more and more ethnic cleansing and what I think will be more and more apartheid findings. And that is ultimately the pressure on J Street. And I think that it will ultimately, I don't know how soon, but these things, as we've seen with the racial injustice demonstrations in the United States, and other political movements from the left for same-sex marriage in the United States, these things happen very swiftly when they happen. And J Street is aware of that and is trying to position itself carefully. But I think ultimately the thought I would conclude with is that J Street is more vulnerable to the left than it is to the right, because the left is developing, and the left center and the non-Jewish progressive movement is developing a strong impatience with Zionism and a clear understanding that Zionism is the problem. So thank you, Dale. And if there are any questions, happy to take them. And I hope I didn't go over my time limit. I'm really don't want to wear out my welcome here.
Maybe now we can go, Julia. I see some questions pouring in here out of the corner of my eye.
Yeah, so, there are quite a few.
Wow.
Yeah, one of the-
I gotta run.
One of the questions is regarding the J Street conference and Peter Beinhardt's appearance there. So how does he relate to J Street now? He's moved a bit left of them. How was he received when he was there?
You know, It's a great question. And I think we need to, this is again part of J Street's balancing act. Peter Beinart is this very respected Jewish intellectual who has been not ostracized from the Jewish community and who has come out, in the last year for one state in Israel and Palestine. He's accepted the reality. Israel's never going to disgorge these occupied territories. And so let's have one democratic state. Everyone has equal rights. How hard is that to figure out? He has not come out for BDS. He's not come out against Zionism as such. I mean, there are certain ways that he has not satisfied the left wing demands on pressure on him. But he's been very, I think he's done wonderful work in terms of moving the Jewish community and moving the discussion generally. Your question, and so he was at J Street. The funny thing about Peter Beinart being at J Street is they didn't ask him about that. He was there to discuss anti-Semitism, a different subject. He wasn't there. They weren't putting him on a platform to say, hey, Peter, why are you for one state? Similarly, Michael Svard, the Israeli human rights attorney, has described Israel as an apartheid state in the last few months. They had Michael Svard on, but Michael talked about deepening occupation. So they were very careful to take these figures. I felt J Street was being very careful about taking these left-wing figures who have real standing on the left, and justifiably, they've spent some political capital to support human rights and human freedom, all that the left is, all that any of us really who in democracy want to stand for. It took these figures who are pro-democratic and sort of had them discuss subjects a little off their area. So I think J Street is made extremely uncomfortable by the democracy discourse. And again, that's all we're talking about is, hey, can you have a democracy? You have 12 million people there under your control. Half of them can't vote. Another third of them or whatever, 20% or 10%, what, second-class citizens. Let's have a democracy on an ethnic basis. That's why they're calling it apartheid.
And another question is then, so does J Street at all deal with the three specific BDS demands? Do they even acknowledge those three separate demands, or they just vilify BDS the other way, the way that other Zionist organizations do?
J Street vilifies BDS. We need to be very clear about that, that J Street has supported legislation that went through that describes BDS as an anti-Semitic, as containing elements of anti-Semitism. So essentially, BDS is anti-Semitic. Well, you have a right to support BDS. They also say the free speech thing. So J Street has vilified BDS. I think that if you were to ask J Street about the three specific demands, they would say that, yes, we're against the occupation. We would support boycott. We don't actually have a campaign on this grounds, but we would support boycott aimed only at the occupied territories, as if somehow the occupied territories are distinct from Israel now, after 53 years with nearly 700,000 Israeli Jews living there and being part and parcel of the Israeli state. So we don't mind your plank BDS with respect to the occupied territories. Your plank about equal rights for Palestinians inside Israel, well, Israel's a democracy and these people vote and yeah, we're against the nation state law and other things that derogate Palestinian citizenship, but we wouldn't boycott Israel on that basis. And as to the right of return, we want a right of return to the Palestinian state under the two-state solution. All these refugees can come back to this small portion of the land that would go to a Palestinian state. We don't want them coming back to Israel, per se. So I think they're very much against the right of return of refugees. And even their imagined right that they give refugees to return to a Palestinian state, well, it's been 73 years or whatever since the UN voted to partition and create a Palestinian state. There's never been a Palestinian state in 75 years. There's not going to be one in another 75. I don't know where these refugees are supposed to go.
Great. I mean, that's a tough question. Another question here about the wondering what has been the effect of the ongoing Black Lives Matter movement on J Street's perception of apartheid, or if anything, on affecting J Street?
It's a great question. It's a beautiful question. I mean, I think it's fantastic. Again, I think Zaha can speak to this a little bit because the Carnegie report that she's involved with, some of the discussion addresses that very issue, that this is creating the structural racism in the United States. Any focus on that is just speeding and enabling a discussion of the racism that we are supporting in Israel and Palestine. And so I think it's had a very beneficial effect. And obviously there are elements of the movement for Black Lives that created a lot of this these protests. There's an element of that organization that is very strongly supportive of Palestinian rights. And it has been part of the platform of the Movement for Black Lives. I think they've waffled a little on their Palestinian support, but clearly, I mean, someone like Mark Lamont Hill, a great leader on that side of in that movement, has embraced Palestinian rights nobly and has lost his job at CNN over it. And I think that that has played a very big part in all this. And I think that's something that terrifies J Street. Is J Street is aligned with a Jewish social justice tradition, which is firmly on the side of Black Lives Matter and on the side of scrutiny of civil rights and racism in the United States. J Street is right in the head of that parade, and it's afraid it's about to go to Israel and Palestine, which it will.
So how effective is J Street going to be in navigating this smaller and smaller space between the left and the right when they're dealing with Congress or their membership?
You know, everything I predict is always wrong. So I want to say that they won't be successful. So that means that they will be successful. I think that's the correct. Anyway, no, I guess I'd say that J Street has been they've been nimble and effective at getting as far as they have. I can't, they want access. They want to play the power game in Washington. They've done pretty good. I think they have really done pretty good. And they've sold out principles that I care about in doing so. But they've gotten what they've wanted, more and more access. So while I want to believe that they're going to be crushed between the right and the left, and the left is ultimately going to overwhelm them and they're going to have to come out against a Jewish state, I'm afraid that they're going to be around for a while and that they will have exercised a considerable influence. I mean, the great thing is that they're supporting the Iran deal. And so there's a great incremental role that they play. And I look forward to their playing that role. I think that they are going to be, the problem is, again, that they are going to be just as bad as Netanyahu on certain things, which is the right of Jews to have a nation in land that was populated by non-Jews. And that's one where at their conference, I should have emphasized this, Isaac Herzog, a left-wing leader in Israel, expresses the most right-wing ideas. And those are Zionism. And J Street is a Zionist organization. So this crisis of Zionism that I want to create, that people on the left want to create, I don't know that I think J Street is going to be able to dance around that for as long as possible. And given that they are at the forefront of change in the Congress right now, supporting a legislation only 15 Congress people support, they are still looking pretty good on the left. But so I hope that answers that question.
I have one more question, if we have time.
One more.
So this goes to kind of looking at some of the racism that's part of that Zionist ideology and wondering, you know, at J Street, did anybody discuss the inequity of the vaccine rollout in Israel versus Palestinian territories? Because all we hear about is how great Israel is doing with that, but not really hearing or reading anything about what's happening in the Palestinian territories or with Palestinian citizens of Israel?
Julie, I'm sorry that I told Dale that I had sat through the entire J Street conference, which is true. I was online all last weekend. I was sitting here doing my hard work. The many stations of the progress of J Street. I didn't hear that one. I did not hear that as a concern. So I think they'd made good statements on that issue, actually. So I don't want to castigate them in an unfair way. But I didn't hear any talk about that. I did, as I say, hear a lot of references to the Jewish state and the importance of the Jews having self-determination in their own land. And just to conclude, these are statements that, you know, Netanyahu makes, and that you heard speakers at J Street saying, finally, historically, Jews have the right, sovereign right to determine our own fate in our own land. And left-wingers in Israel will say this, quote-unquote left-wingers, because that is Zionism. And so that's the ultimate dilemma, I think, to repeat myself ad nauseum.
Excellent, excellent. So thank you very much, Phil. If you haven't seen this great post by Philip Weiss, J Street's Magical Thinking, you really need to check that out. But now we are going to move along. Thomas Suarez is best known for his 2016 book, State of Terror, How Terrorism Created Modern Israel, described by Ilan Pappe as, quote, the first comprehensive and structured analysis of the violence and terror employed by the Zionist movement and later the state of Israel against the people of Palestine. And it really is an amazing book, and I encourage anyone who's interested to pick that up. Thomas Suarez's more recent book is Writings on the Wall, which is an annotated collection of Palestinian oral histories. He's the author as well of three highly regarded books on the history of cartography, and also a Juilliard-trained violinist who has performed around the world. He's a former faculty member of Palestine's National Conservatory of Music. So he'll be analyzing the recent Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism, and why the adoption of guidelines such as this JDA and International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, etc., working definition of anti-Semitism, why this is so important to pro-Israel factions and many other details. So thank you very much, Thomas.
Thank you, Grant. And my great thanks to the Washington Report for Middle East Affairs and everyone who made this event possible. Why? The first question is, why is the definition of anti-Semitism relevant to the question of ending U.S. support for Israeli apartheid, or as I would put it, for apartheid Israel, since apartheid is in the nature of the state itself. It's not an external aspect of it that can be switched off. Well, the definition of anti-Semitism is key because the principal weapon being used to squelch any honest reckoning is the word anti-Semitism. And so even before turning to the New Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism, we need to ask why the definition of bigotry against Jews, unlike bigotry against the rest of humanity, came to be a contested issue needing its own elaborate definitions. On the face of it, the very idea would itself seem to be anti-Semitic, playing into the libel of Jewish exceptionalism. So before we go any further, who or what is keeping the medieval idea of Jews as a race apart, not only alive, but official U.S. policy? To me, the answer is obvious and indeed reflected in the JDA at issue. The Israeli state promotes and depends on Jewish separatism, in part because the use of the smear to block debate requires it. And so I think the JDA can only be understood by starting from the beginning. when in the late 19th century, the idea of a so-called Jewish state was being championed, only one true site for this state was possible, Palestine. Other locations were considered, but as Herzl made clear, they were only considered as stepping stones to Palestine if Palestine could not be gotten at first. It had to be Palestine because the Zionist project needed a massive influx of Jewish settlers, and Herzl believed that this would be impossible without the magic of the word Palestine, the land of the Bible. Continuing on through the decades leading up to 1948, Zionism's appeal and exploits continued to be couched in the language of messianism. As one example, Ben-Gurion, at a secret meeting in 1941 in London, he was blunt. Without a biblical name for their proposed state, he said, they would never attract enough Jewish settlers. And so, he said, it had to be called either Israel or Judea. The messianic ploy continues today and reinforces Israel's impunity. After all, it's one thing to criticize a country, but quite another to make accusations against the land in the Bible that seems to be a product of Genesis itself. And as loony as it sounds to make a connection between the Israeli state that self-declared itself in 1948 and the realm of the Old Testament, it touches the Western collective's subconscious and secures the fervent support among Christian Zionists. But even this messianic advertising gimmick did not at first elicit the enthusiasm Zionists needed. Their project, indeed, was widely seen as an affront to Jewish identity. And I think this is best reflected. I'd like to read from 1897, still 20 years before Balfour, the London Standard, in my mind, summed up the situation perfectly. I will read it. Zionism finds little favor in Germany except among the anti-Semites. In short, the degeneration, which calls itself anti-Semitism, has begotten the degeneration which adorns itself with the name of Zionism. End of quote. But the messianic angle was exploited to depict Jews worldwide as a single monolithic tribe and Zionism its high priest, inseparable from Jewish identity itself. During the years of the British Mandate, Zionist intimidation against Jews to secure compliance with this idea, with this abuse, was so extreme that most victims of Zionist assassination, that is, a targeted killing rather than just the victims of its indiscriminate carnage, were not British, were not Palestinians, but were Jews who were vocally unsympathetic to Zionism. Families were ostracized if they did not submit. Students were blocked from advancement if they did not submit, and on, leading to where we are today. By consolidating its claimed ownership of Jewish identity, Israel spins criticism of it, the state, as hatred of Jews, since, according to this construct, they're one and the same. This is why the simple matter of what is anti-Jewish racism turns into a lengthy document invoking the Israeli state, as the JDA unfortunately does. For decades, Israel's apologists waged this weapon on Israel's behalf, intimidating, smearing, and silencing critics with the smear of anti-Semitism. But as the years passed, cracks developed in Israel's narrative of a benevolent nation defending itself. It largely contained a public relations debacle after the so-called Cass-led massacres against Gaza, 2008-2009, but found itself dealing with unprecedented grassroots outrage following its even more horrific Protective Edge massacres in the summer of 2014. And so in the wake of this post-Protective Edge slip in control over its narrative, Israel responded with a two-pronged strategy. One was IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition, to which the JDA is a response. The very purpose of IHRA was to give perceived legal endorsement to Israel's use of Jewish identity as a human shield to empower its crimes. And its use of the word Holocaust in its title exploiting the memory of Hitler's victims to empower new ethnic crimes made it all the more obscene. IRA lifted Israel's use of the anti-Semitism smear from the uncertainties of allegation or opinion and raised it to the level of perceived dispassionate fact. The anti-Semitism tactic was no longer just street warfare. It was now official policy among many of Israel's benefactors, principally in the EU, the UK, and, of course, the United States. This weapon has caused great damage even among governments and institutions who have not formally adopted it, but nonetheless find themselves judged by it and threatened by it. And two, in the wake of Protective Edge, new organizations were established to wield IHRA under the veneer of fighting anti-Semitism. Foremost among these is the so-called Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, the CAA, which, as a result of its Orwellian name, its status as a registered UK charity, and further helped by a special waiver allowing it to keep secret who is behind it despite charity status, has had a great deal of influence in wielding lies of anti-Semitism on Israel's behalf. And unfortunately, the CAA has been further popularized by many well-meaning people unaware of what the organization actually is. And this brings us to the Jerusalem Declaration on Anti-Semitism, which arose in response to the chaos and destruction caused by IHRA. Now, unlike IHRA, the JDA does contain an actual definition of anti-Semitism. I will read it. I quote from the JDA. Anti-Semitism is discrimination, prejudice, hostility, or violence against Jews as Jews or Jewish institutions as Jewish. Yes, now even this is longer than it really needs to be, but it's fine. But the problem is that this definition is qualified by a preface and a set of guidelines which preserve the fundamental abuses of the IHRA, still framing bigotry against Jews in context of the Israeli state and the so-called conflict, and still defining the terms under which Israel's crimes may be challenged. Now, to be sure, it is not only a vastly, vastly better document than IHRA, it is also, unlike IHRA, a document which I think was composed in good faith. But it was composed in good faith within the confines of a particular mindset. The JDA discusses hostility to Israel, which it says might be anti-Semitic animus. Okay, already we have accepted that there is some intrinsic link between Jews as Jews and the apartheid state of Israel. Okay, but if we are going to have this linkage, the JDA makes a dangerous inversion. It implicitly insulates the very people we should all fear, white supremacist apologists like Donald Trump, or neo-fascists like Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. And it is telling that Israel is fast buddies with such people. True anti-Semites, people who harbor hatred of Jews as Jews, are far more likely to be wholly supportive of the Israeli state. White supremacists and fascists love Israel because of their bigotry. Another clause addresses a possible reason for Palestinian, quote, hostility to Israel. This hostility, quote, could be the emotion that a Palestinian person feels on account of their experience at the hands of the state. Now, this is the only use of the word emotion in the entire document, yet it is used to explain the reaction of the very people who have the most fact-based, lived experience over 7.5 decades for entirely rational hostility to the state. Unfortunately, this invites Israel's supporters to explain away Palestinian opposition to their shackles as emotion, reinforcing existing racist stereotypes in the West. Another guideline addresses anti-Semitism hiding in coded speech. And here again, Israel is the topic. Grossly exaggerating its, Israel's, actual influence can be a coded way of racializing and stigmatizing Jews. Now, hold on here. Alleging influence of the Israeli state, right or wrong, has nothing to do with anti-Semitism unless it is said to be synonymous with the Jews as a people. And ironically, who claims to speak for all Jews as Jews? It's the very basis of the Israeli state. The JDA states that evidence-based criticism of Israel as a state is not, on the face of it, anti-Semitic. Okay, in other words, evidence-based criticism of Israel still might be anti-Semitic. But more to the point, whether the criticism is by some undefined criteria evidence-based is irrelevant to the topic of anti-Semitism. All that matters is whether the criticism, or more likely the accolades, stem from prejudice against Jews as Jews. And those who engage in such anti-Semitism are merely taking Israel and Zionism at its word. But the ultimate internal contradiction of the document is found in the final clause among what it calls examples that, on the face of it, are anti-Semitic. And it is all the more problematic because it is written in a way to sound like a good thing to a public winged on the Zionist narrative. I will read it. It reads thus: denying the right of Jews in the state of Israel to exist and flourish collectively and individually as Jews in accordance with the principle of equality. Now, on the face of it, this reads as a self-evident truth. But what does it mean? First, it implicitly means that in order not to be anti-Semitic, we must accept the existence of the Israeli state, a state that still refuses to define what it is and where it is. Now, personally, I don't think any state has the intrinsic natural right to exist. People have the right to exist, and states are social structures that exist at the pleasure of those it serves. Does Israel exist at the pleasure of a majority of the people whose lives it controls? Obviously not. And so it is all the more confusing that the clause then says, with the principle of equality. But we have to assume that everybody is supposed to be equal and not just Jews. If everybody is finally equal after 73 years, then by definition, Israel will treat the people it ethnically cleansed from the land equally with all the people who had no link whatsoever with the land, but were ethnically correct settlers. Israel created itself by importing Jews alone, as settlers, to create an ethnically pure state replacing the indigenous people. And so the principle of equality would be a far straight out of Orwell's Animal Farm, unless Israel stopped blocking millions of Palestinians in Gaza, in the West Bank, in the camps and surrounding countries and beyond, from returning home. Now suddenly equal, they would return to their own homes on their own land, but find them occupied by, as the JDA puts it, Jews in the state of Israel. This is a conundrum of Israel's making and Israel's alone. In fact, the principle of equality would return millions of Palestinian businesses, orchards, assets, factories, and industries stolen by the Israeli state and its settlers to their rightful owners. And to be sure, without that wholesale theft of a ready-made country, the new state would doubtfully have ever existed. In short, the principle of equality would mean that there was never an Israeli state. All along, the JDA presumes a dangerous falsehood, that Israel wants an end to anti-Semitism. No, let's step back and not be forced to view the world on Israel's terms. The Zionist ideology and the Israeli state are addicted to anti-Semitism, whether real or invented through fraudulent definitions. And what kind of anti-Semitism does Israel focus on? It rails on about its invented anti-Semitism of the progressive left, because the true progressive left is anti-racist and thus against Israel's racism. Actual anti-Jewish racism is not Israel's focus because it is pro-Israel. And the JDA is informed by Israel's upside-down anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism as a permanent state of humanity is what gives Zionism and Israel meaning. And the never-ending fear it generates helps keep the cult obedient. Related to this, there is one final and I think very important, yet to my knowledge, overlooked reason for all the to-do over the definition of anti-Semitism. I see these deliberations and the JDA as in part an attempt, even an unconscious attempt, to come to grips with the psychosis that I believe Zionism created and Israel nurtures. As we've seen, Israel, in order to cast criticism of it as anti-Semitic, and in order to cast anti-Zionist Jews as heretics and traitors, presents itself as identical with Jews as Jews. This remains Israel's primary military weapon. But Zionism's great Achilles heel, which I personally believe will be its ultimate downfall, is that inescapably, according to this equation, Jews, by sheer virtue of being Jews, and as an ethnicity, are the doers of Israel's crimes. Yet the pressure to remain in the cult is enormous. We often hear the libel of the self-hating Jew intended to prevent dissent. But this began right with Herzl, whose condemnation of traditional non-Zionist Jews sounds straight out of the worst Nazi propaganda, and I am not exaggerating. Now, regular, decent people who like to think of themselves as fair-minded and certainly moral would not want to think that they are party to ongoing crimes against humanity. And as an aside, when the U.S. invasion against Vietnam was ongoing, I, along with millions of other U.S. citizens, we felt no organic connection to our country's crimes and instead felt a responsibility to do what we could to stop it. Now, the government may have called us traitors, but traitors to what? To something diametrically opposed to our self-identity. It was a compliment. Our self-identity had no connection with what any particular nation state did. But what about people who were raised to believe, or I would say brainwashed to believe, that Zionism and the Israeli state are integral to who they are, part of the DNA, not an option? This is no sweat for criminals. But for regular people, it's a nightmare, complete cognitive dissonance. They must somehow square on one hand, wanting to believe that they are fair-minded people, while at the same time believing that their non-negotiable self-identity requires that they support massacres, apartheid, and ongoing ethnic cleansing. And if you read accounts of people freeing themselves of Zionism, it is truly the ordeal of leaving a cult. I see the JDA as, in part, an attempt to make sense of the contradictions of Zionist self-identity versus personal morality. If I am correct, it is important to understand that this is a powerful, invisible component of why the definition of anti-Semitism gets garbled with Israel and Zionism. In short, intertwining the two numbs the pain of the dissonance with convoluted complications that seem to externalize the moral reality. I thought it was revealing that in a video on the JDA website, the moderator states that, quote, we can't forget how complex anti-Semitism is. It's a shapeshifter. It keeps changing. Now, how to explain this? Systematic discrimination against Jews is happily long gone in the United States and many other parts of the world. Jews are not at risk of garden variety discrimination here in the United States or in Britain, but they are at risk of deadly violence and by the same forces that Arabs and other people perceived as others, and ultimately all of us, are at risk from: white supremacists, the radical right, and neo-fascism. And it is a constant phenomenon, not a shapeshifter. So how to explain the fog over what constitutes hatred of Jews, making it intangible, elusive, and always intertwined with limits of what may be said about a non sequitur, the Israeli state, except to keep forever at a distance the reckoning of admitting to oneself the moral quandary of Zionism. To finish up, in my opinion, although the JDA is obviously far better than IHRA, its vague, contradictory, and convoluted preface and guidelines prevent it from being a vehicle to free us from the cynical abuse of anti-Semitism by Israel, its supporters, and the various anti-progressive forces that couldn't care less about Israel, but for whom the anti-Semitism smear is an effective, handy weapon. Thank you.
That was Monda Weiss's Phil Weiss and historian and author Tom Suarez. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.